In his book, Growing Strong in the Seasons of Life, Christian author Charles Swindoll tells a story about a 19th century agnostic named Thomas Huxley. And Huxley is one who was, who promoted Darwinism and humanism in his attacks on Christianity throughout his life. But the story is about Huxley was in Dublin and was rushing to catch a train. And he climbed aboard one of Dublin's most famous horse-drawn taxis and said to the driver, "Hurry, I'm almost late, go fast, drive fast." And off they went in a furious pace, and Huxley sat in the back of his seat with his eyes closed, trying to rest as they hurriedly tried to get to the station. After a while, Huxley opened his eyes and glanced out the window and noticed that they were going in the wrong direction from the station. And realizing that he hadn't told the driver exactly where to go, but just how to go, he called out to the driver, "Do you know where you're going?" And the driver replied, "No, Your Honor, but I'm driving very fast." And many of us can relate our lives to this story. Maybe sometimes we don't know exactly where it is we are going. We don't exactly know what it is that we are supposed to be doing or where it is we're supposed to be heading. But we all know that we're going as fast as we can. We're working hard towards wherever it is we're going. We're moving fast in that direction. And in doing so, a lot of times we maybe come up against a wall in our lives, and we come up against a time in our lives where we ask ourselves some questions. And this morning, I want to focus on a couple questions this morning that we tend to ask ourselves throughout our lives. And the first question I want to take a look at is this question about who am I? And a lot of times we have this question. We have, well, who am I? What am I supposed to do? Who am I? And we need to realize that each one of us has been, or each one of us was created by God. Every one of us here this morning was created by God. And since we were created by God, we have a calling on our lives. And this goes all the way back to the beginning of Genesis, in Genesis chapter 1, when God created Adam. When God created Adam, he had a calling on Adam's life. And Adam's his calling, he had the responsibility of taking care of the garden there until him and Eve messed up and got kicked out of the garden. But that was his calling to he was in charge of naming the animals. He was in charge of taking care of the garden there. That was his calling. And so many times today, we take that calling, or we hear the word calling in our Christian way of thinking, and we say, you know what, that only applies for ministry purposes. Saying, you know what, this person was called to go into the ministry, or this person has been called to go onto the mission field, or this person, and we keep it in those sort of circles instead of realizing that each one of us here this morning has a calling on our lives. And because of that, and because God created us, we have that. I want to look at Genesis chapter 1 as we kind of answer this question, who am I? And looking in Genesis chapter 1, after God had created everything that we see, as we see the sky and the stars and the sun and the waters and the land, as he's created that, in Genesis chapter 1, verses 26 and 27, we read about who we are. It says, "Then God said, 'Let us make human beings in our own image to be like us. They will reign over the fish in the sea, the birds in the sky, the livestock, all the wild animals on the earth, and the small animals that scurry along the ground.'" So God created human beings in his own image. In the image of God, he created them. Male and female, he created them. And so when we try to ask ourselves and we try to answer this question, who am I? And we see at the very beginning when God created us, we have been created. We have been born with the image of God. God's imprint is on our lives. God's imprint is on anyone's life who is ever born, whether they serve him, whether they acknowledge him, whether they accept him or not. His imprint is on their lives. And no matter how hard we try, no matter how far we run, no matter where it is that we go, we cannot change this. We have all been created in this image. And so when we ask ourselves, who am I? And who is me? And we need to realize that we are someone who is created in the image of God. The same God that hung the stars, that hung the moon, the same God that put the water on the ground, the same God that was creative enough to design all of these different animals, and the same God who created all of these mountains and landscapes and everything that we see created each one of us. And it doesn't matter what somebody has labeled us. It doesn't matter what somebody has called us or made us feel like. We have all been created in this image. Too many times we allow something, a coworker or a classmate or a spouse or a family member or a friend, neighbor, that has said something to us or about us to identify who we are. And we can't look past that or that always hangs around in the back of our minds. We can't move on from that. Instead, I want to encourage you to start thinking of yourself and realizing that you are identified by the one who created you. And so when we figure out what our calling is, when we figure out and try to answer, okay, we all have this calling in our life, it starts with, okay, who am I? We got to start with the ground level. We got to start with the basic level. And we know that we have been created in the image of God. And then we move on and we answer this question, who is with me? We know that we're created by God, but who is physically with me on this journey? In the Garden of Eden, until Adam and Eve messed up and sinned, God was walking with them. They had that opportunity to walk with God and talk with God in the garden. But many times in our lives today, we feel like we are by ourselves. We feel like we are the only Christian in our workplace. We feel like we're the only Christian in our neighborhood. Or sometimes we feel like we're the only Christian in our own household. And we want to know, who is with me on this journey? Who's there to help me? Who's there to support me? Who is there to encourage me? And we all have some sort of, we all crave some sort of community. We all crave having that fellowship and that friendship with other people. Some people crave it and need it more than others. But all of us, down to the core, crave some sort of community with other people. And we flip over a chapter in Genesis, from Genesis chapter 1 to Genesis chapter 2. We see this in verses 21 through 24. So the Lord God caused the man to fall into a deep sleep. While the man slept, the Lord God took out one of the man's ribs and closed up the opening. Then the Lord God made a woman from the rib, and he brought her to the man. At last, the man exclaimed, this one is bone from my bone and flesh from my flesh. She will be called woman because she was taken from man. This explains why a man leaves his father and mother, and is joined to his wife, and the two are united as one. Adam needed he enjoyed having and being able to walk with God and talk with God, but it was something about having another human being along with him, and so God created this, and we realize that in our lives the idea of community is important, the idea of fellowship, the idea of friendship, the idea of having somebody in our lives is important, and this means surrounding yourself with people. Who will be there for you. And how we can do that today is by getting involved at church, getting involved with different classes, getting involved with different groups or activities or Bible studies or things that are going on here at the church. And by doing that, by creating those relationships, this all develops community and helps us answer, okay, who's going to be with me on this journey? Who's going to be there when I need them the most? And so when we think about this calling, we think about, okay, we know who we are. We know that we are created by God. We are created in the image of God. And then we look at who is with me. We talk about the idea of having that support, having that community with you. Now when we look at what this calling is, and we're going to spend the rest of the time talking about this, and we're going to really look into this. This is a million-dollar question about what our calling is, and it's what am I here for? We want to know what it is, what are we doing here on this earth? Why has God placed us here at this time, at this moment, and in this generation? And I mentioned earlier that we all have a calling in our lives. And sometimes in our Christian bubble, we've made it seem that the only people who have a calling are ministers or missionaries or people who are doing the work of God full time. And there's a calling for that as well. But there's also a calling on our lives. I remember when I felt God tugging at me to go into the ministry. Being a high school student and the people that he used in my life to speak encouragement, to speak wisdom into my life, and I'm forever grateful for that calling. But I want us to realize this morning, and I want us to realize as a church body that the calling that God places in lives isn't just for ministry. He places a call in all of our lives as his followers. And just as he calls people into full-time ministry as an occupation, God is calling for doctors, he's calling for lawyers, he's calling for teachers and nurses and first responders, he's calling for mechanics, he's calling for businessmen and businesswomen into ministry in their own environment. I just finished reading a book this last week. It was called The Great Evangelical Recession. And in the book, the author shared a quote, and I want to share that with you this morning. And this is what he says. He says, do you have that to put on the screen? It says, our greatest potential for reaching the lost is not a celebrity leader, but millions less known everyday believers. And so many times we think somebody else can win other people for Christ. But what we see here is the calling that God places on our lives is us as individuals. You guys have opportunities that other people do not to reach certain people in your lives. And that's the greatest potential we have. And so when we take a look at this calling that Jesus has put on our lives, it's to live as his disciples. It's to live as his followers. And we'll be constantly asking and wondering, what am I here for until we truly live this out? And when talking about followers of Jesus, it's not just that we go to church on a Sunday morning. It's just not that we read our Bible on a daily basis, or we've been baptized, or we pray, or we give in the offering plate each week. Our calling is a lot deeper than this. And I want to take a look at a story with Jesus and a crowd of people in Luke chapter 14. And Jesus confronts this problem about what our calling is and about what we are supposed to do. And he makes it very clear, as we're going to take a look in Luke chapter 14, what it means to be a Christian. And therefore, we can answer the question, what am I here for? Because as people and as individuals who are created in the image of God, we are here to serve our Creator. And in Luke chapter 14, we see how this plays out. Now, we look at the word disciple, and this week I looked up the word disciple in the dictionary, and with a couple definitions that were given, there was two words in both definitions given with the word disciple, and that was the word follower. And so when we think about what our calling is, I want us to look this morning on how we can answer our call to be a Jesus follower. So look in Luke chapter 14, and we're going to start with verses 25 through 27, and this is what it says. A large crowd was following Jesus. He turned around and said to them, if you want to be my disciple, you must hate everyone else by comparison, your father and your mother, your wife and children, brothers and sisters, yes, even your own life. Otherwise, you cannot be my disciple. And if you do not carry your own cross and follow me, you cannot be my disciple. when taking a look at what's going on here in the story of Luke chapter 14, I want you to notice who Jesus is speaking with about being his disciple. Luke notes specifically that it says large crowds were following Jesus and that Jesus specifically turned to them and elaborated on being a disciple. These were people who were following Jesus, a large amount of people who were following him. And Jesus turned around and he turned to them. He went to them. It wasn't like he was talking. I mean, some of these people may have been, but if they were following him, they had an interest in him. So they weren't essentially all agnostic towards him or those who were uninterested in his life and his message. But these were people who were traveling with Jesus. They were following him as he was going around. And they were interested in what he had to say. They wouldn't be following him if they didn't have some sort of interest in what it is he was trying to say or what it is he was trying to do. They apparently took the positive attitude and the interest in Jesus for what true discipleship is, and many of us do the same thing today. They considered themselves to be followers of Jesus because they were going around with him. They were listening to what he had to say. But in reality, they were only casually following him and not really committed. And they didn't want to give too much to be followers of him. And we think about this idea of giving too much. It reminds me of a story of two brothers who were getting ready to boil some eggs to color for Easter. The one brother says, "I'll give you $1 if you let me break 3 eggs over your head," said the older one. "Promise," said the younger one. "Promise," gleefully the older boy said, and he broke the 2 eggs over his brother's head. And standing stiff in fear of the gooey mess to get all over him, the little boy replied, "When is the 3rd egg coming?" "It's not," replied the brother, "because that would cost me $1. And many times when we think about following Jesus, many times we think about what is something going to cost us, we always weigh that option. What is it going to cost me? And with thinking about our calling as a Jesus follower, sometimes we will only go as far as we can without it costing us something, without it costing us our time or our money or our energy or whatever it may be. And much like the crowd who was gathered to listen to Jesus, they were only willing to go so far. They were willing and anxious to follow Jesus, providing that what Jesus was going to say and what Jesus was going to tell them to do was not too high or the demands weren't too great on their lives. And it's like many times today, people who do Christian things and think that's going to cover it. They go to church or they pray on a regular basis. They sing Christian songs or they listen to Christian radio in their car. But they're not really totally fully committed day in and day out to following Jesus. In a sense, they were just along for the ride, but were unwilling to give up everything in their lives that were conflicted with following Jesus in a committed way that he is calling us to do. Too many times we, like today, we look to Jesus to solve our money problems, our relationship problems, our health problems, but who are quickly unwilling to obey Jesus completely when following Jesus doesn't solve these problems, when he doesn't help us, or following Jesus requires a real sacrifice in our lives. And as we looked at the words in verses 26 and 27, Jesus addresses this mistaken understanding of what discipleship really is. He explains in vivid terms and clear terms what it means to be a disciple, what it means to be a follower, a true follower of him. He says, in our hearts, Jesus must come before our loved ones, our self-interest, our possessions, our careers, our hobbies, and even our very own lives. And in practice, this commitment to Jesus will be tested on from time to time. And sometimes in a moment of weakness, Jesus won't always be our first choice. In verse 26, again, he says that this commitment level applies to anyone who comes to me. And I want you to see that word, anyone who comes to me. And Jesus isn't specifically, exclusively talking to a special group of Christians. He's not talking to his 12. He's not talking to 12 disciples. He's not talking to certain missionaries or ministers or even mature believers. But he's saying, anyone who comes to me. And he's saying that this principle applies to everyone who would be one of his followers. And so it's not for a select few. It's not for those who know more about the Bible than anybody else to fully give their lives to Christ. It's anybody who accepts him, anybody who comes to him, anyone who meets him. And some look at the words, and a lot of times people look at the words of what Jesus said in verse 26 and think, man, those are some strong words. Did Jesus really mean that? Did he really mean that we, what he said in verse 26? And he uses these words to get the attention of those who are listening and to those who are reading. Because when you look at what he says in verse 26, it is eye-catching. He says, if you want to be my disciple, you must hate everyone else by comparison. And we think of what Jesus teaches and what he models throughout his life. And then he says this, and it's like, wow, what does he want? This seems harsh. This seems real. And he's using it to get their attention. In the Jewish culture, the word hate was used to express a lesser love for something. So Jesus is saying that we must love him much more than we love our closest friends, than we love our closest family, than our closest relationships, and even our own lives. Because so many times we see the word hate today and we see the negative connotation it has, and we see that and we're like, this is what Jesus wants me to feel like, to follow him? But he's saying, he's wanting us to put him and our relationship with him above anything else in our lives. We must love him more than our hobbies. We must love him more than our goals in life. We must love him more than our self-interest. And Jesus is not just speaking of our emotional feelings toward him or our families, but rather he's speaking of our level of commitment. He's saying that our commitment to obey, our commitment to follow him must be greater than any other commitment in our lives. And we look at our lives today and we see how many things we are committed to. We see how many things that we have on our calendars. And sadly, and as frustrating as it is, too many times today, the first thing to go in somebody's lives, the first commitment to go is their commitment to the church and their commitment to God. And this is what Jesus is talking about here. He's saying that our commitment to obey and our commitment to follow him must be greater than any other commitment in our lives. Jesus must be first in our priorities and our loyalties. And sometimes we have to look at ourselves. We have to look at ourselves in the mirror. We have to look at our calendars. We have to look at our priorities and say, am I committed to following Jesus? For instance, if following Jesus obediently results in problems or interferes with your closest relationships, will you still follow Jesus? In other countries, following Jesus can sometimes mean being kicked out of your family or losing your children, or as we've seen too many times in the news recently, losing your own life. We've seen in our own country many relationships have encountered problems because somebody else, a spouse, was committed to following Jesus and the other spouse wasn't, or friendships have broken because one friend was committed to following Jesus and the other friend was not. And in such cases, Jesus wants us to know up front what it means to follow him. He's laying the groundwork for us. He's saying, this is what it's going to mean to follow me. If you really want to be my disciple, if you really want to be a follower and do what I say, this is what needs to happen. Jesus, must come before our closest relationships. And then in verse 27, Jesus uses a metaphor to reemphasize this point. And the crowd that Jesus was speaking to was very familiar with what he was referring to when he was saying, you know what, you must carry his cross. And we know through Jesus' time that in the Roman culture, the cross was a cruel form of punishment. And a criminal was forced to carry their cross to the place of execution. And this was their way of saying goodbye to everything because they were losing their life. There was no turning back. And Jesus used this vivid illustration with the intent of showing us, showing the reader, showing the listeners that he's speaking with just how committed he wants us to be. Now we, today reading this, have the hindsight of looking back and seeing what Jesus did, how he gave up his life and sacrificed his life and died for our sins. And we see that. But his followers here and now who are listening to him in Luke chapter 14, they don't know that what he's going to do. And so he's really driving home saying, you know what, you really have to be committed. You really have to do this. But then we see that he also does the same thing for us. This coming Saturday, I'm attempting to run my first ever mini marathon here in Columbus. And for those of you that don't know, a mini marathon is 13.1 miles. And a few years ago, in my personal life, I got to a point where I wasn't happy with the weight I gained, so I started running. And I started this program called Couch Potato to 5K. And it got somebody who was a couch potato in position to run a 5K. And since then, I've ran a handful of 5Ks. Well, last year was the first year for the marathon here in Columbus, and I ran the 5K that was down there at Millrace. And as I was down there, I had some friends who ran the mini marathon. So I was down when I got done waiting for them to finish because the 5K was a lot shorter. And I'm sitting there, I'm watching these people cross, and I'm like, you know, I think I want to do the mini marathon, not really thinking it through all the way, thinking, man, that sounds like a good idea. And so I told a couple people I would. I kind of did that because so they could help keep me accountable so I didn't back out, and then got to a point where I signed up and I actually paid money to do it. So it's like, okay, I paid money to do it. I am going to do it. But there's been a commitment level to this event. I'm not just going to wake up on Saturday morning and roll out of bed and run 13.1 miles. Without any training. I've been training at least for this off and on since May, but really kicked in these last 12 weeks. And basically what my weeks consist of running is I do two short runs a week, which is anywhere from 2 to 5 miles, and then I'll do a long run one day a week, which is typically on my day off because it usually takes me a little longer to do that I can't do in the evenings. In fact, my long run this last week was 12 miles. And running 12 miles and driving 12 miles is a lot different. You really put into perspective how far it is when you do that. And so next week, I mean, I kept moving up each week on my long run. So I'm ready for that 13, for that extra 1.1 miles on Saturday. Now, when thinking about doing this and thinking about entering the race, in no way, shape, or form did I plan on or think that I'm going to win the race when I signed up. I signed up because it was something that I wanted to challenge myself with, and also to set out some goals, a goal time that I want to finish under, and to be able to finish the race without walking. And the last couple weeks when I've ran 11 and 12 miles, I've actually not had to walk one. So I'm very proud of myself and happy with where I'm at with that. But I mention all this because I couldn't do this if I wasn't committed to my training. And our calling of being Jesus followers requires a commitment to the end goal. Every time I got up to run, every time I went out to run, and there's an end goal in mind to make it to this coming Saturday, to be able to finish this race and to be able to do something I never thought I'd be able to do. And it's the same way with following Jesus. There's an end goal in sight. And we need to stay committed throughout all of our lives, not just in different seasons when things are going good or when things seem to be going great in our lives, but we need to stay committed to Jesus throughout the entirety of our lives. I want to pick back up in the story in Luke chapter 14, looking at verses 28 through 33. Jesus continues to say, but don't begin until you count the cost. For who would begin construction of a building without first calculating the cost to see if there was enough money to finish it? Otherwise, you might be Otherwise, you might complete only the foundation before running out of money, and then everyone would laugh at you. Then they would say, there's the person who started that building and couldn't afford to finish it. Or what king would go to war against another king without first sitting down with his counselors to discuss whether his army of 10,000 could defeat the 20,000 soldiers marching against him? And if he can't, he will send a delegation to discuss terms of peace while the enemy is still far away. So you cannot become my disciple without giving up everything you own. We look at what Jesus says, and in these two illustrations that he shares, he is expressing one simple but very important point. And his point is that just like it's wise to consider the cost before building something, or just like it's wise to consider what you have before you go into war, so it's practical and it's necessary for us to take into the account the cost and the commitment necessary to follow Jesus. Jesus doesn't want people to make a commitment to him without understanding and seriously thinking about what is involved in this decision. Jesus doesn't want a half-hearted or a blind commitment that expects only blessings and good times in their lives. Anybody who's been a follower of Jesus and walked with him on a daily basis realizes that there are peaks and valleys through that time and in our journey with Jesus. I mentioned earlier about the race this coming week and the training. And working my way up the ladder on my long runs, to say that I was excited to run 7, 8, 9, 10, 11 miles at a time would be an understatement. I remember before my 10-mile run, 10 miles was the longest I've ever ran at one time in my entire life. I was getting ready to go out that morning, and as I'm getting ready to walk out the door, I just finished filling up my water bottle, and I had it in hand, and I was getting ready to go, and Abby asked me if I was ready for my full 10 miles, and I said, I'm ready for that or Jesus, whichever one I see first. We'll see what happens. And through my training, I've had to push myself. I've had to motivate myself. I felt like not running. There's been times where I've been running and I've fallen. Hopefully you didn't see me. I prayed that a couple times that cars drove by me when I fell, they didn't stop to help me because I was already embarrassed enough. But I wanted to quit. My body hurt, my legs hurt, but I had to keep going. I was focusing on the commitment to my training. I wasn't going to let my unwillingness, I wasn't going to let my whatever was going on to keep me from doing that. And so many times we allow that to happen in our relationship with Jesus. We allow how we feel to dictate what it is we're going to do for Jesus. Or we allow what's going on in our lives or how much he's blessed us to how am I going to serve him. And each of us should consider and make sure we're willing to pay the cost prior to making the commitment to following Jesus, knowing that when we accept him and we come forward and we accept that gift that he's given us, that's not the end of the road. There's still a lot more to be done. We should also be committed to following through on our calling to be Jesus followers. And Jesus wants to ask ourselves, am I in this for the long haul? He's asking, are you willing to follow me no matter what happens? Are you what you're required to give up? Unlike people today who focus on numbers, Jesus wasn't interested in that. Large crowds didn't impress him, but he wanted was totally committed people. And think about that. He spoke a lot to large crowds and he went around teaching, but when he spent a lot of his time and effort and energy, it was with his 12 disciples, and he wanted to make sure how committed they were. And that's what he wants from us. He wants a commitment from us. And the condition of much of the church today indicates that we have many who are just a part of the crowd and not true disciples. The church as a whole, that is. There are many who have not listened to Jesus and considered the call. So we just sign up and say, you know what? I'll accept him. I'll become a member. I'll become a Christian. And this is why there's a lot of polls out there and a lot of things that show there's very little difference between the way that the world lives and professed Christians live their lives. When thinking, there's a story that I read this week that demonstrates a lack of commitment from Christians that happened in Washington, D.C. on Palm Sunday in 2002. I want to share that with you. On that day, the city had scheduled a marathon, which greatly interfered with the normal traffic on a Sunday in Washington, D.C. And the leaders of various churches were upset and made their feelings known in local papers because of this event. Many churches reported that on that particular day, attendance was down 50 to 70%. And many people asked why was it not possible to get to church on that day, and that's not the case. But the race did delay traffic for those who went to church and delayed traffic about 15 to 30 minutes. And many regular church attendees, by their own admission, who were asked, were unwilling to take the extra time to fight traffic and get to church on that Sunday. Sadly, such an attitude doesn't seem fitting for what Jesus is talking about here in Luke chapter 14. Who are supposed to be willing to give their lives to follow Jesus, but yet wouldn't sacrifice spending that time on their way to church? And these kinds of things and moral compromises and half-hearted commitment would not be happening if people realized and understood that what was required of his disciples and they had considered the cost as Jesus instructed. In finishing this parable, Jesus continues in verses 34 through 35. He says, "Salt is good for seasoning, but if it loses its flavor, how do you make it salty again? Flavorless salt is a good neither for the soil nor the manure pile. It is thrown away. Anyone with ears to hear should listen and understand." Jesus routinely uses salt as a figurative ways during his ministry because of the high value people had for salt during those times. And salt was used as a preservative and flavoring and even as a sort of fertilizer. And salt, in this case, represents a person's commitment, what Jesus is talking about here. As he's wrapping everything up, he's talking about the salt representing somebody's commitment to him. And when the commitment is complete, the salt is good. And this means that a Christian's life will have a positive and useful purpose in the same way as good salt did for the people. And when salt wasn't good, Jesus is saying it couldn't even be used for fertilizer, as Jesus said. He's saying it was unfit for the soil or the manure pile. In other words, it was useless in every respect. And Jesus is saying that people who follow him without total commitment are like the salt that has lost its saltiness. They may have the appearance of being his disciples, as the salt has the appearance of being the salt, but they are not answering their calling. And Jesus was referring to those who only give part of their lives to him. They will commit to following Jesus one day a week or when he's traveling around, but not the other 6 days of the week. They will commit to obeying him in their marriage or in other parts of their life, but not 100% of their life. They will give up this thing but not that thing to follow Jesus. This half-hearted commitment will not work in the same way salt that has lost its saltiness is of no use. And then Jesus concludes his parable by saying, "He who has ears, let him hear." He said this to remind us of our responsibility to listen and to respond to this difficult calling. Because when we look at what Jesus is talking about here, the teaching is not difficult to understand. We see what it says. We understand what it says. But what is difficult is the application of it. And so we started by asking and by making this statement, we all have a calling. And I want you to understand what our calling is as Jesus has defined it. And the question we need to ask ourselves is not, what am I here for? But let's ask ourselves, am I willing to do what I'm called to do? We're all human, and sometimes we fail in our commitment. But the thing Jesus is confronting here is not our ability. He's not asking about our ability or good things we can do, But what he's looking at is he's looking at our willingness to follow him with our whole hearts. And some of you have not made that choice to initially follow Jesus, and we want to give you that opportunity this morning, that chance this morning to answer that call. But for many of us in here this morning who are already Christians, who've already said, you know what, I've accepted him, let this be a reminder of what our calling is. Let this be a reminder of the excitement that you had when you first walked up and you stepped into those waters of baptism and what it really means to be a true follower of Jesus. And no matter what our calling is, no matter what he's calling us to do in our lives, in our homes, in our work, or how different it may be from the person sitting next to you, there's one thing that we all have in common with our call, and that is to respond. We started at the very beginning in Genesis chapter 1, and ever since then, God is constantly pursuing a relationship with us. When he created Adam, he was pursuing that relationship, and God was pursuing that relationship with people throughout the history of the Bible, and he's still doing that today. And so we have to ask ourselves, are we ready to answer that call? And we want to give you that opportunity this morning. Will you stand and will you pray with me?